Hey everyone, welcome back to the forum, where science comes to socialize.
And to all you first timers, a very warm welcome to you as well. Thanks for choosing to spend some time with us today.
I'm Daniela, and that was Aubrey just now. And as usual with us today, we also have our co-host Cleo, and all three of us are coming to you from the Institute on Science for Global Policy.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in.
So today's episode is a super relevant one. Not that our other episodes aren't.
Go on.
Well, today's episode is related to infectious disease impacts, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation recently committed $258.3 million to malaria-related research and development.
Oh, right. I heard about that.
Yeah, so while that sort of commitment is necessary, today's episode speaks more about perceiving the risk of infectious diseases and the impacts of how we react to those risks. So that's the relation to our current events shout out for the beginning of this episode.
So we're talking more about risk perception than about the actual diseases themselves?
Exactly. So today's episode specifically discusses a policy position paper written by Dr. Paul Slovic titled Communication Challenges and Managing Social and Economic Impacts of Emerging Infectious Diseases. The paper was debated at an IHGP conference held at George Mason University, which itself was titled Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases, Focus on the Societal and Economic Context.
Dr. Slovic is a professor of psychology and president of decision research at the University of Oregon.
And you can find Dr. Slovic's paper, plus many more infectious disease-related papers if you're interested, over on the ISGP's website at scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Although, call me biased, but you should just listen to our past podcasts on them instead. We have an entire playlist on our SoundCloud channel dedicated to them. And speaking of online media, feel free to send us your questions and comments on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook if you go over to facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
So as you might have guessed from the title of Dr. Slovic's paper, today's conversation will involve an interdisciplinary approach to infectious disease, which seems perfect for us, an interdisciplinary team. We'll be discussing economic issues, social issues, and communication issues, especially as they intersect with perceptions of disease risk and the impacts of those perceptions.
And seeing as we all know communication is not your strong point, Dee, well, at least not in English, I think I'll take it from here.
Hey!
I'm just teasing.
Yeah. Anyway, science communication is your specialty, so I'll just let you have this one. Go for it.
All right, so let's begin by first making two things clear. First, many diverse factors, which include the laundry list of global transport, climate change, migration, population growth, urbanization, and bioterrorism, are facilitating the spread of infectious diseases. And second, it's abundantly clear that risk, whether concerning food safety, climate impacts, or infectious disease, is inherently hard to understand and communicate.
Today, we'll connect the dots between these two statements that Cleo just made, since the threat of emerging and persistent infectious disease is exacerbated by problems of communication, risk perception, and decision making. And since we'll spend a lot of time on risk today, we should probably start with an in-depth analysis of risk and how people even grapple with the concept.
Since a standard definition of risk has not been widely established or accepted, the effective communication of risk to both the public and decision makers remains pretty difficult.
For a quick linguistic lesson, definitions of risk really vary depending on the professional context in which they're developed. For example, actuaries versus medical professions have drastically different definitions of risk. These different definitions include different meanings like risk as a hazard, risk as a probability, and risk as a consequence.
Humans simultaneously process information about risks in two seemingly contradictory ways. One way being through feelings, or the fast intuitive gut reaction, and the second way being reason, or analysis, or the slow, thoughtful, scientific way of analyzing risk.
In the ancient world, risk assessments were primarily based on gut feelings and experience, for example, by processing questions such as, how does the water smell? Or, did I get sick when I drank the water?
However, in the modern world, of course, science is used to measure and identify even very small risks. Thank you, low detection limits. This scientific information can actually complicate a person's ability to determine a hazard's true level of risk, And the reason why isn't just because science is hard or whatever. It's actually because this sort of data-based info often conflicts with an individual's gut instincts, the feelings that people have grown to trust based on literal evolution.
And on an evolutionary timescale, humans have only recently become capable of, and interested in, thinking more abstractly about risk. In other words, we've only recently begun worrying about things that can't be seen or events that are happening in other parts of the world, which, if anyone knows me personally, is how I got the nickname Worrywart.
Oh yes, evolution did not work out well for you here. You are such a worrywart.
I honestly wouldn't be surprised if you now started worrying about being a worrier.
Hey.
You know, we're just messing with you, Dee. No need to fret. Anyway, an interesting point that was noted at the debate is that people generally make decisions about risk based on feelings that stem from past experiences instead of explicitly analyzing and calculating risk. Big surprise there.
Yeah, that actually sounds more annoying than interesting to me personally. The effective communication of risk to the public and policymakers, not to mention in everyday conversation, is frequently complicated by the difficulties many have in considering issues analytically. People often assess issues of risk emotionally rather than methodically by considering the facts, which just seems so much more reliable.
Well, as much as I agree with you about needing to appreciate evidence-based approaches and facts, you also know me and my proudly emotional self. We may get into a little feelings versus analytics debate. Interesting or annoying, however you perceive it, debaters did agree that in many situations, feelings are valid and beneficial for split-second decision-making.
True, but under other circumstances, however, feelings do not always produce appropriate reactions because they can be misleading. Particularly when an experience is new or when messages are crafted in ways that over or understimulate certain emotions, like the TV commercials with sad puppies, sad music, and sad Sarah McLachlan.
Aubrey has a point here, as these feelings can be a reaction to prevalent stigmas, including ones that may lead to avoiding people, places, or products perceived to be abnormally risky. In relation to frequent forum topics, you can think of GMOs as an example.
Mm-hmm. Emotional thinking, which tends to place a lot of emphasis on personal or one-off experiences, can really underestimate the importance of large-scope scenarios that can really only be described by statistics. Stories of the individual tend to carry much more emotional meaning and impact.
This is what leads to overreaction. And of course, avoidance of those stigmatized people, places, and products can lead to massive social and economic impacts.
Misunderstandings about risk can easily cause overreaction. When individuals assess risk through rational analysis, on the other hand, multiple dimensions of risk are then taken into account, including the severity of the consequences and the likelihood of the event.
However, when risks with potentially severe outcomes, like terrorist actions, if you want an extreme example, are evaluated with feelings, individuals frequently overlook the true probability of an occurrence. They then act as though the threat is more likely to manifest than it is in reality. Evaluating risks without properly analyzing the probability of an event can lead to inappropriately allocating financial and human resources.
But in some cases, the incorrect perceptions of risk leads to underreaction. People often maintain cognitive bias against what's considered normal for a society, such as common or persistent infectious diseases, even when the opposite threats, in this case, new diseases, may be dangerous. Underreactions to risks can be just as problematic as overreactions.
So in the context of this episode, effective communication is essential to reduce the direct health effects from infectious diseases, as well as the indirect social and economic costs due to stigma. This sort of dangerous stigmatization, by the way, happened during the plague in the Middle Ages, if you like history, as well as more recently with outbreaks of severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, H1N1 influenza, and bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE. These latter episodes have led to billions of dollars in losses globally.
And these losses and stigmatization could be avoided if we use our words properly. Consider a rare, harmful event that is expected to occur with extremely low probability. If that risk is communicated as occurring in, let's say, 1% of exposed individuals, people will tend to perceive it as much less risky than if they were told it was going to occur in 1 out of every 100 exposed persons. Slight shifts in communication tactic can result in widely different interpretations, even when the content of what's being communicated remains the same.
Right. In this case, the framing of 1 out of 100 exposed persons stimulates thoughts and images of the one victim, resulting in stronger negative feelings and greater perceived risk.
And on top of that, word selection is also super important. Pandemic, for example, creates a scarier impression than does epidemic.
And this may be just because the role of trust in behavioral economics is one of my favorite topics to talk about, but I do feel like trust belongs somewhere in this conversation.
Yeah, of course, it is entrenched in this conversation. It's crucial to acknowledge its significance as an additional influence that dictates how we feel, so it's closely associated with perception and acceptance of risk.
And as we all know from personal experiences, trust is hard-earned, but can be permanently destroyed in an instant.
Right. And instead of getting into some dramatic example there, I'm just going to keep moving on. So another emotional bias that Dr. Slovic explains is probability neglect, occurring in people and governments facing an uncertain event that's dreadful to contemplate. For example here, the strong feelings triggered by worst case scenarios can lead to overreaction because people fail to take probabilities, which may be minuscule, into account. This may ultimately result in, surprise, surprise, poor decision-making.
There have routinely been significant differences between what the evidence says and what the emotions say, especially in cases where perceptions of risk are highly influenced by cultural factors and societal values.
So, for effective risk messaging to be formulated, there is a need for cultural and societal issues to be understood and not simply dismissed as irrelevant, which can, unfortunately, happen easily when they don't align with technical assessments of risk.
To better incorporate different worldviews, risk messaging needs to be shaped in cooperation with those who understand the specific society being targeted. This person or these people could then act as liaisons to the message recipients.
So what you're saying is that it makes sense to argue that risk communicators need to understand the subtlety and power of images and feelings, a skill that advertisers and consumer marketers have honed for decades. Yes, I'm talking about you, Geico.
They might be my favorite commercials, but this all definitely makes sense. But as we mentioned before, there are valid uses for both analytic feelings and gut reaction feelings under different circumstances. The difficulty is that they coexist in the mind pretty much all of the time.
Well, under both circumstances, risk communication necessitates an understanding of people's perceptions of risk. Risk perceptions are greatly influenced by the unique set of factors that comprise a risk or hazard. In other words, whether the exposure is voluntary or involuntary, controllable or uncontrollable, or leads to immediate versus delayed consequences.
Individual values that relate to these factors play an important role in how risk is perceived and accepted. For example, many people perceive exposure to radiation from nuclear energy generation as high risk because, whether or not it's true, they think the radiation is relatively uncontrolled, involuntary, and capable of causing severe consequences.
In contrast, medical uses of radiation, such as medical X-rays, have been way more widely accepted. It was also noted during the debate that people commonly view situations or actions as either risky or safe, with little middle ground between the two ends of the spectrum, which is pretty interesting, actually, because the severity of consequences can be so diverse.
And to add in another health-related concern, Dr. Slovic explained that some societies, specifically parts of the world with lower life expectancies, were considered more heavily exposed to risk than other populations. Debaters questioned what level of risk is acceptable, as well as whether people who live in such societies are less sensitive to risk because they have built up a tolerance to potential hazards.
Taking all these factors into account, after developing an understanding of people's perceptions of risk, communicators need to conduct research to determine whether their messages are being understood and acted upon appropriately. Furthermore, if researchers determine how people perceive hazards, culturally sensitive messages can be formulated to minimize the misinterpretations of risks.
Communication strategies can then be tailored to fit the characteristics of the exposed population as well as the nature of the threat.
The development of clear, evidence-based messages for the public presents great opportunities to reduce the social and economic costs of disease, which, as we explained, can be massive. Consider, for example, a bioterrorism incident, such as distribution of anthrax spores in a major urban area. Methods for studying the social and economic impacts of such an event have been developed and involve a scenario simulation that uses video simulation of an unfolding series of local news reports on such an anthrax incident.
By watching how people react to these videos, certain questions can then be answered, including whether residents will remain in the city, what personal, financial, social, and political considerations influence those decisions, what changes in perceptions and actions occur during the cleanup and recovery period, and even what economic incentives can facilitate recovery.
Simulation affords opportunities to intervene with messaging to determine which types of messages lead to the most appropriate behavioral responses. For example, risk perception research suggests that giving people an understanding of what officials are doing to control and minimize exposure and harm, and what they personally can do to control the risk, is essential to mitigating the harmful consequences of actions driven by fear.
Scenarios educating people about disease events and building trust and action plans can be thought of as a communications analogy to the biological principle of inoculation. This is where a person is exposed to a mild dose of a virus to stimulate her defenses against a subsequent stronger attack.
This might sound a bit strange, but actually, inoculation theory was developed by social psychologist William J. McGuire in 1961 and was first used to explain how attitudes and beliefs change, and more importantly, how to keep existing attitudes and beliefs consistent in the face of attempts to change them. Now it's, of course, gaining prominence in health campaigns and other domains.
And speaking of changing attitudes and beliefs, we've got to address the elephant in the room: rampant misinformation. The acceptance of misinformation, made ever more common with the popularity of social media, tends to be exacerbated when people aren't educated about concepts related to risk, probability, data, and uncertainty. While science relies heavily on probability, many in the public aren't educated about how to think probabilistically.
Kind of like that scene in that movie, This Is the End, where Seth Rogen explains that he quit gluten. Such a funny scene.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm not liking the sound of this already.
You've never seen This Is the End?
Literally, what is that?
Such a good movie. Although you're right, I'm not sure it's very much your taste. Anyway, the scene involves Seth Rogen explaining that he stopped eating gluten because it's bad for you. And then another character starts questioning him on why, and basically Seth Rogen admits that he doesn't even know what gluten is and is only quitting because everyone else is doing it. Perfect example of how misinformation gets easily passed around through social media. The risks of eating gluten are perceived to be serious, while in fact there's no risk at all.
Well, unless you're gluten intolerant, of course.
Which Aubrey is. But while I'm just as much of a fan of Seth Rogen as you are, Dee, we might want to get back on topic.
Right. So we were talking about people's ability to think about probability and risk rather than through emotion. But the issue is that education on risk and probability is typically only provided to the small percentage of the global population who take statistics courses in college or in grad school. It was argued that probability is as important as other mathematical sciences, but is often neglected in education.
But even if risk assessment is properly introduced into the educational system, debaters express concern that there's only a small, fragmented community of risk communicators out there.
And since most of the research on psychology of risk assessment is being done and conducted within Western populations, there's also a deficiency in our understanding of how other cultures think about risk.
Okay, so what kind of actionable steps can policymakers, risk communicators, and the general public take away from our episode?
Okay, so debaters suggested that when conveying information about risk, policymakers need to frame messages as stories, narratives, and anecdotes, a lot like we discussed in some really old forum episodes on science communication. Check out episode 10, Stories by Scientists, as an example. At the same time, though, as Dee touched on earlier, providing overly charged information is discouraged because sensationalized messages can create an air raid mentality, leading to poor outcomes such as unwarranted economic losses and social unrest.
And speaking of Dee's tangents, conveying messages through trusted messengers was noted as an especially important component of effective risk communication. To ensure maximum effectiveness of risk messaging, the risk communication community must prioritize trust by working with scientists and well-known public figures to ensure the credibility of each message.
And testing these messages among a large community of experts in advance of their dissemination can also ensure their impact.
Similarly, the importance of the context within which risk messages are framed was repeatedly highlighted. Risk comparisons, such as stating that nuclear power is safer than driving a car, are really useful ways of explaining risks since they connect the event itself with the probability of it actually occurring. While comparisons don't always work perfectly, it was argued they're often a valuable tool.
And if you're wondering if risk messaging has ever been successful in the past, it turns out that the 2009 swine flu pandemic is a pretty good example. Five key characteristics made this communications effort successful. First, messages were created in advance of the first announced case of the disease.
Second, messages were unified with four consistent talking points used by federal agencies.
Third, continual updates were provided to the public, including what was known and what was unknown.
Fourth, messaging was delivered by a source with authority.
And finally, there were also positive and personal news stories, such as updates on the progress of immunization. In fact, research in Canada showed that during the outbreak, daily public updates by national authorities led to increased immunization rates.
In comparison, the 2001 U.S. anthrax attacks were presented as an example of unsuccessful risk communication because the messages that were conveyed were not consistent with the threat.
In any case, as one of our most common forum themes, there can be no one-size-fits-all model for communication. As we've mentioned before, strategies must be culturally appropriate and sensitive to diversity of population backgrounds, resources, and available technologies, as well as being tailored to the many threats posed by infectious disease.
Well, this seems like a good place to wrap up, shall we?
Alrighty, so today, Daniela and I got into a little debate ourselves within this debate summary. It's like debate inception.
Good one.
Good one.
Thanks, guys. Anyway, today we outlined the distinction between emotion-based perceptions of risk and analytical perceptions of risk.
We explained how developing effective risk communication requires a clear and accurate understanding of the cultural perceptions of risk within a society, as well as a specific worldview and values that shape such perceptions.
And although compared with other interventions, such as drug development for infectious diseases, timely risk communication is low cost and simple. Its effectiveness often depends on engaging local individuals who understand the specific cultural context and who can serve as the liaison between the messenger and the message recipients.
On top of all of this, risk communication is complicated by people's limited understanding of the meaning of data, probability, and uncertainty. Convincing people to move beyond their emotional assessment of risk and to actually think analytically is a real challenge for essentially all risk communicators.
So, educational efforts are needed to improve the ability of the general population, including children, to properly assess risks via rational analysis and to avoid decisions based on only emotional responses. So, now that we know what Dr. Slovic and the debaters think, I think it's time to ask our audience to join the conversation.
What do you think about social media as a viable platform for risk communication? Should authorities be using it as a tool? And if so, how can the public distinguish between reliable information and misleading accusations?
How do you feel about the use of analytics to perceive risk? Are you fluent in understanding data and uncertainty? Would you be willing to take a class if one was easily accessible to you?
And most importantly, of course, let us know your thoughts on the emotions versus analytics debate. Do both have a valid role in perceiving risk and decision making?
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter using our handle at ISGPForum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
From all of us at ISGP's The Forum, we appreciate you hanging out with us today, and we look forward to having you join us next time as we socialize with science. We'll see you then, right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.